MechCast, Thursday, October 10th, 2019. Hey, Mech Geeks, it's time for your MechCast, the show for Mech Geeks by Mech Geeks. I'm Adam, and this is the show where we discuss all things Macintosh. How you doing? Welcome back to the MacCast. Hope you're having a great week so far. It's been a little crazy for me, but things are going okay. And looking through Mac stuff, well, we have some good stuff to talk about. Big thing happened this week, of course. A new version of Mac OS was released. Mac OS Catalina is out and available. So I, of course, I'm going to share my experiences with you on upgrading. And I did upgrade this time. Those of you who are long-time listeners to the MacCast know that I often wait quite a while. I think when I upgraded to, what was before Mojave? High Sierra. It took me almost a year. I did it almost right before Mojave came out. And I was pretty quick to upgrade to Mojave, but I usually wait a couple months. This time I decided to throw caution in the wind and just jump on in. So I'll share my experience. I know many of you have been emailing me to talk about your impressions and experiences. Don't have a lot of those stories to share yet, but probably in the next MacCast, maybe some of you can send in some audio comments. And I did throw out a request for audio comments last show, and boy, did you respond. So we've got a lot of great feedback from listeners, some great questions to get into. We're going to be talking about things like, let's see, what do we got in the notes here? Some follow-up items. Some of you chimed in on App Store updates, on AppleCare, photo sharing. I had made a comment about that and wishing that it was more family-friendly, or there were more family options, I guess. Someone reminded me about something, so we'll get into that a little bit. We did get one question about Catalina that we'll dive into. Also, a review. Our friend Tim sent us a review of Apple Watch. And then also Apple Watch question. And then there was a mystery that happened this week. Somebody was having some trouble with the TV app, and that's a little bit bizarre, so we'll talk about that a little bit. Looks like it is probably a bug. And then also, I was playing around with a new feature in Shortcuts in iOS 13, something that a listener told me about. They were planning some things, and I wanted to dive in and play around with it myself, so we'll talk about that. So more shortcut stuff. I know we've been doing that a little bit, and more I'm getting some great tips and tricks on shortcuts from you. And with iOS 13, it is really expanded. So if you haven't taken a look at shortcuts in iOS 13, I encourage you to pop open the app and take a look. A little automation on iOS never hurt. So we're kind of doing the intro backwards this week, I guess, talking about what we're going to talk about toward the end of the show. Of course, we have news to get into as well. Not a ton of news. Ming-Chi Kuo weighing in on some iPhone growth. There's a new repair program we have to talk about. Apple Card had a little bit of a security issue. I want to talk about that because there was a lot of sort of FUD, you know, floating around, as happens when these things go on. So Apple had touted security of Apple Card, and there was a little tiny issue, but probably they made more of a mountain out of a molehill, so to speak. And then some more information on Apple's sleep tracking and a possible app. So all that in the news. It should be a good episode, so stay tuned. But before we get into everything, I do want to take a quick moment and thank a show sponsor, and that is Cashfly. You know, I love Cashfly because they help me get this show to you. Without them, you really wouldn't be hearing this show right now. They provide the bandwidth for the MacCast. They make sure the episodes get to you quickly and reliably. They have been great at that. But guess what? They also can help you do stuff for your website and your business. Specifically, get your websites to load faster, because when websites don't load, people lose interest. As a matter of fact, for every second a page takes to load, it costs a company about 16% in engagement. And fewer visits means fewer customers. And if you're trying to make revenue, that's not a good thing. So Cashfly has your back with their new web optimization capabilities. All of your content will be optimized before it is delivered to your visitors without requiring any development effort from you. So that's important because they make it easy. With the addition of CacheFly's flexible Edge application platform and implementation services, their capabilities reach far beyond that of any other traditional CDN. CacheFly's web content optimization solution includes powerful APIs for solving your content distribution problems, next-gen on-the-fly image optimization, application load balancing, and smart asset delivery. Listen, if your website is directly tied to your revenue, and you know it is, optimize your website's content now. Guarantee the best user experience for all your customers, no matter where they are, or what device they're using, and do it today. The folks at CacheFly are even going to give you a free optimization consultation just for listeners of this podcast. That's right, just for you. Know exactly where your website stands today with a Lighthouse score report and learn more about how CacheFly's web optimization solutions can help you add 60 points instantly to your score. Just visit mac.cachefly.com. That's M-A-C. CacheFly.com now to get your free Lighthouse score report and learn more about CacheFly's web optimization solution. We love CacheFly. Great service. Check them out. And big thank you to them for their support of the MacCast and for delivering it so reliably to you each and every week. Going to probably want to listen up to this first story if you are an iPhone 6S owner, especially if you've had some issues with your device, because Apple has just launched a repair program for some owners of the iPhone 6S. Apple is offering to fix some issues customers are having with power on their 6S or iPhone 6S Plus phones. Apple says that in some cases, the devices may fail due to a faulty component. They say the affected models were sold between October 2018 and August 2019, and that users can check their serial numbers for eligibility on Apple's support website. I'll have a link in the show notes at maccast.com. And if you are eligible for a repair, you can get the repairs done free of charge by Apple at an Apple retail store or at an Apple authorized service provider. You can go into the store, you can visit your local Apple authorized service provider, or contact Apple via phone support via AppleCare to arrange to mail in your device and have it serviced. So if you've run into power issues and you're an owner of an iPhone 6S, 6S Plus, you're probably going to want to check this one out. Ming-Chi Kuo is predicting iPhone growth for the first quarter of 2020. As you know, we've been talking on the MacCast over the past couple of years about kind of slowing iPhone sales. iPhone sales have tended to drop a little bit year over year, or just rather remain pretty steady, right? We've talked about the fact that it's a mature product. It's not doing a lot in terms of sales. Well, with the release of the iPhone 11, Ming-Chi Kuo thinks there's a possible little turnaround happening. Also, that there will be a little bit of a bump up if Apple releases a rumored replacement for the iPhone SE. That could drive iPhone shipments up in the first quarter of 2020. As a matter of fact, he expects shipments to grow around 10% year over year in that first quarter. He says that iPhone 11 replacement demand seems to be a big driving force, and that iPhone demand should be driven up even further if Apple does launch a more affordable replacement for the iPhone SE. As far as what that phone looks like, well, a few of you are going to be a little bit disappointed if you're hoping for a smaller model, because he says, nope, it's actually going to be very similar in form factor and in specifications to the iPhone 8. It will have a faster A13 chip and 3 gigabytes of RAM, but design-wise, be the same. So a lot of people are calling it an iPhone SE 2. It doesn't sound like that's what it really is going to be. What it is going to be is a new, more affordable entry-level iPhone with more modern specs. I would imagine that it would have the dual-lens camera system, probably some of the other more modern features, a nice little bump up from the feature set in the iPhone SE, but will have that iPhone 8 size. So Apple having this trend of kind of moving to bigger phones. I think maybe the days of smaller devices, much to the chagrin of many in our community, I know because I hear from you, I get your emails. A lot of people like that 4-inch form factor and would like Apple to stick with it. Sounds like that may not be the case, but at least we'll have a lower price point. And all that adds up to Apple probably selling more phones in the first quarter, which is good news. Quo also says that next year's iPad refresh will have a 3D time-of-flight camera, which is something that was also expected and has been rumored for the 2020 iPhones. We've been hearing a lot about it with regard to the iPhones, but we haven't heard about that camera system coming to the iPads until now. It's believed that this year's iPad Pro updates, expected this month, will adopt the triple lens camera system of this year's iPhone 11 Pros. And so looking at that, I'm thinking this kind of signals what is probably a new trend, that the Pro models between the iPhones and the iPads are probably going to continue to have the same camera systems. It hasn't been that way in the past. Typically, the iPad has just had, and I'm looking at my iPad Pro right now, the single lens camera system. And so now we're talking about a bump up in this year to a full triple lens Pro camera system. And then in 2020, the same trend continuing with the iPhones maybe in the fall getting a time of flight 3D camera system, and then that same camera system moving into the refresh, which typically happens in October, of the iPad Pros. And Ming-Chi Kuo did weigh in again on the possible refresh of the MacBook line. This time around, he says that in the second quarter of 2020, Apple will be doing a full MacBook lineup refresh, bringing the scissor switch keyboard design that has been rumored for the 16-inch model that is expected to be announced this month, possibly. So the MacBook Pro 16-inch, we've heard a lot about that. It is expected to be a replacement for the 15-inch MacBook Pro and would be the first one to bring this new scissor switch design, moving away from the butterfly keyboard that has plagued Apple's laptops for the last few years with reliability issues. So we're expecting a better keyboard, which is good news. We're also hearing rumors that the 16-inch model may have a new, more powerful power adapter, a 96-watt power adapter, which would be a bump up from the 87-watt adapter that is included with the 15-inch MacBook Pro. What's interesting about this is that Apple's Pro Display XDR, which is also due out soon before the end of the year, offers up, guess what, 96 watts of power through its Thunderbolt 3 ports. So I don't think it's a coincidence that Apple's new MacBook Pro is going to have the same power profile as what is output on their new Pro Display, right? Makes sense. So getting a little bit more power in the 16-inch model, and that's a pretty big, big bunch of juice, which is interesting because Apple has had this trend to try and get more energy efficient, right? Their whole green initiative. But with this one, they're going to have to do a bigger power supply. And then finally, Ming-Chi Kuo is predicting that Apple will collaborate with third-party brands to launch its AR headset accessory for the iPhone in the second quarter of next year. We've been hearing a lot of rumors about Apple doing AR headset, either glasses or maybe more of a VR kind of thing. Nobody really knows. A lot of the indications seem to be leaning more toward some sort of device that would work in conjunction with your iPhone. It's not clear if it would be a sort of stereo display that your iPhone would mount in or if it would be a full accessory, but some sort of AR headset. We've seen references in the latest versions of iOS 13 and the betas. The design, like I said, and exactly what the accessories will look like are up to debate, but Ming-Chi Kuo seems to think that Apple will be working with third-party brands to put that together, which is interesting. Apple doesn't collaborate too often. They do it every once in a while, and sounds like they may move in that direction. So I'd be curious to see if it was something that Apple co-developed with a number of third-party brands to kind of bring out different options and at different price points. If it's the sort of thing where it's something that your iPhone would slide into in some way, I could see that happening, where it's almost like a case or an accessory, and there's different features with different manufacturers and things like that. But that wasn't in what Ming-Chi Kuo said. He just said they're working with third-party brands. I'm just doing a little extrapolating and speculating there. So what do you think about that? What are your thoughts on an AR headset? Is that something you'd be interested in? With Apple's focus on Apple Arcade and gaming, there could be some interesting things there. So certainly seems like a direction to move in. It's becoming popular with things like the Oculus models and those sorts of things. So I know a lot of my friends are really into it. I haven't gotten myself too much into AR or VR, but AR... It has some interesting applications that I think might benefit a lot of people. If it's more of kind of a heads-up display, glasses kinds of thing, I'm a little bit more interested in that and than just a pure VR experience. And then one last thing, because there is a new beta of iOS out to developers, iOS 13.2 beta 2, and Guillermo Rambo had been poking around in there and discovered a new animation. We've been talking about the fact that it looks like Apple's getting set to have some new AirPods on the market, and one of the big key features that we're hearing about is that it might have noise cancellation. Well, Guillermo Rambo found a little animation that seems to demonstrate possibly how you will use that noise cancellation feature with your AirPods in Control Center. It's a kind of primitive, not quite finished animation at this point, but basically you would go into Control Center, you would taptic touch on the volume slider, and that would bring up some additional controls, including a little slider, or to me it looked more like a toggle for controlling the noise cancellation. So I'm assuming that means the level or the amount of noise cancellation if it turns out to be a slider. I'm thinking more it's a, you can either turn noise cancellation on or turn it off, which is something that I would really like, because I'd like to have noise cancellation in some scenarios, but a lot of times when I'm just out and about, maybe I'm out exercising or going for a walk, yeah, you want to be able to hear other cars or people coming up behind you, those sorts of things. So these are looking like, as far as the design goes, to be more of an in-ear style with kind of maybe some rubberized tips. If you look at some of the leaked images that we've seen, some of the reference images that have shown up in iOS beta, I'm not so sure how I feel about that. I kind of like my AirPods the way they are now, just sort of sitting in my ear. I've never been a big fan of the ones that you kind of stuff all the way into your ear canal, but we'll have to wait and see. Maybe something that Apple announces this year. I'm thinking more likely we'll see them next year, but the fact that we have indications already in iOS 13 betas, that does seem like that update might be coming sooner than later. Story popped up on 9to5 Mac this week related to Apple Card and security, and it wasn't really good news, especially given the fact that Apple made such a big deal at their announcement about the security of Apple Card. 9to5 Mac reader shared an incident where he had a fraudulent transaction show up on his Apple Card, which was interesting, but it got even more interesting because when he contacted the support to look into it, they said the purchase was actually made with a physical card. And not only that, the purchase location, when he looked at the transaction in Apple Wallet, which one of the features is it will show where the transaction was made on a map, that location was actually faked to be a location near him when the true transaction was done miles and miles away. Now, remember, when you're thinking about this, because the immediate thought was, well, you know, it doesn't have a card number on it. It has all these great security features. How would this possibly happen? Well, the Apple Card still has one big area where it doesn't have new advanced security, and that is the mag stripe that is on the back. It still is a card with a mag stripe, and for that reason, it still can be skimmed. I think we've all, or many of us probably, I shouldn't say all, myself, I know I've fallen victim to this a couple times, most recently at a self-service parking lot terminal. You know, the terminals where you go, you park, and you pay for your slot. Yep, one of those had a little card skimmer on it, and one of my cards got skimmed. It wasn't my Apple card, but it happens to the best of us, and that appears to be what happened in this situation. One thing that I wondered about was, and I assume this happened, that he would have got the pop-up alerting him to the purchase being made, and that was ultimately what maybe got him to contact the bank to try and figure out what was going on. If you are concerned about security with the Apple Card, of course, you do have the ability to use Apple Pay, which is much more secure than using the physical card, and also the ability to use the chip when possible. I don't know a lot about credit card security when it comes to the chip, but I get the impression, especially if it's chip and PIN. Unfortunately, we don't have that in the US, but maybe when they roll out Apple Card internationally, you'll get that. But man, in the US, we got to get rid of that mag stripe. And I think this just proves it, right? Apple Card is great, but it still, at the end of the day, is just a credit card. And with all its great features, I think it's easy to forget. And so I think this story got a little bit sort of blown up in our community for, you know, some legitimate reasons, right? Apple touted the security like it was something more than it really was. And also, you know, we are dealing with a physical credit card, and it is easy to forget that. It does sound like customer service was great in handling it. I don't think he was responsible for any of the charges. It was taken care of. And I do think you have a lot more transparency, again, with the alerts, the transaction history, all that stuff in the wallet. I think it would be much, much easier to spot a fraudulent transaction or this going on. But it does look like they skimmed the card and then cloned it onto a physical fake card, and then were using that in another location. I'd be most curious to figure out how they faked the purchase location data that was passed to, I would assume, and through Goldman Sachs into Apple's system. I haven't seen that has come out yet. I will keep my eye out for it. If anybody in the community sees a story on that or gets more information on how that possibly happened, please let us know. Shoot us an email or an audio comment to maccast@gmail.com. Another couple things about Apple Card. This one pretty cool. It looks like Apple Card is offering, or Apple rather, through Apple Card, is offering disaster relief for some customers affected by recent events, including the flooding in Texas. Some folks in Texas in the impacted areas got emails and notifications from Apple offering them the following with their Apple Card: a no interest for 2 months, starting with the month that you enrolled in the disaster relief program. After 2 months, your standard Apple purchase APR will apply, but you kind of get a 2 month reprieve. You can skip the payment due in the month that you enroll in the program. If you have an account in good standing, it will remain current while you are enrolled. So not making your payment, you're still enrolled. If your account is past due, your account will not go into further delinquency while you're enrolled in the relief program. However, your account will remain past due until you make all your past due payments, and your ability to make new purchases while you're past due will be restricted. But overall, nice little thing Apple's doing to, and of course their partner Goldman Sachs, thing that they're doing to help folks in disaster relief areas. So just a feature of Apple Card that we didn't know it came with. And that was a nice story to see this week. And then one last thing to note about Apple Card, and this came from a listener, but I thought it would be something good for all of us to be aware of in terms of making payments on our Apple Card. Robin discovered that if you make a payment directly from your bank through the wallet app, so one of the big features of Apple Card is you can go into the wallet app, you can make a full payment. You can see also how making partial payments might affect the amount that you're paying, especially in terms of interest. But you can make that payment directly, and you can have it come directly out of your bank account. So if you set that up, you make a manual payment through the app, it turns out that transaction doesn't happen immediately. It actually can take up to 7 business days or longer to actually post with your bank. And Robin was a little bit concerned about that because wanted to make a payment to avoid any interest charges. And I thought that was a bit odd. You know, we live in the digital age. It seems like it shouldn't take that long for the payment to post. But I contacted Goldman Sachs through the app, through the messages, and they definitely confirmed it. They said 7 business days could take even longer. And my concern, as well as Robin's, was, well, what does that mean if I have interest coming up? Am I going to get charged interest payments? And they told me that no, if you make the full payment on or before the due date, as long as the payment goes through, you're not going to incur those interest charges. Now, if the payment doesn't go through, that's a whole different story. So you have to make sure that you are going to be able to make the payment, but as long as it is successful and you get it logged in or make the payment into the app before or on the due date, you should be okay. Of course, you probably want to verify for yourself through Goldman Sachs. I will say, using the chat app, going into the wallet app, tapping on the Apple Card, tapping on the three little dots, and then just contacting support through the app, through messages, is a great experience. They're really responsive. They're really great at answering your questions, and it's just another great feature of Apple Card. So confirm with them yourself, but that is what they told me over chat. More often than not, when we have rumors and speculation about upcoming Apple products, that information comes from Apple's third-party suppliers, the supply chain, various leak sources in the Apple community. But every once in a while, we get a leak that happens directly from Apple themselves, usually and almost always unintentionally. And that did happen this week. Something that we've had rumored for a while is that Apple is working on some sleep functionality for Apple Watch, some sleep tracking, sleep monitoring. Well, this week, the App Store for Apple Watch had in its listing for Apple's Alarms app a screenshot that showed that a possible sleep app might exist and be coming. Basically, it was a screenshot of a wake-up alarm, and the screenshot said, quote, "Set your bedtime and wake up in the sleep app." Apple, of course, replaced the screenshot very quickly after the story broke, but we have heard that Apple is developing sleep tracking and possibly a sleep app for Apple Watch, though nothing has been announced yet. They are expecting the features to have a time in bed tracking option, so you would wear, presumably, your Apple Watch to bed. It would track the amount of sleep that you're getting each night. And it would possibly track the quality of that sleep and even have this option to silently wake you up in the morning. I'm assuming using some taps in the Taptic engine so you don't disturb maybe a partner who you might also be sleeping with. So it's also believed that it would have a dedicated watch face and a few other features. Of course, no official announcement has been made, and it wasn't part of Apple Watch Series 5 or the new Watch OS. So when it's coming, how it's coming, what the features are going to be, still up in the air, but at least internally, they've got some screenshots of something that could be alluding to a sleep app. And several years back, Apple did buy the sleep tracking company Bedit. They sell the product and continue to develop the software for that. So whether that'll be sort of rolled in and become Apple's new sleep tracking offering, it remains to be seen. We're going to have to wait some time on it. But again, some indications this week that it might be coming sooner than later. And with that, that is going to do it for the news for this week. Before we move on, I do want to take a quick moment and thank another show sponsor, and that is Masterclass. Look, I am so enjoying my access to Masterclass, just getting great lessons and content with a variety of courses taught by amazing people, the best talent in their fields, the kind of talent you're not going to find on any other service. Absolutely loving it. Another thing that I love about Masterclass is just the quality of the presentations and courses, and the fact that each of the courses is very unique to the presenter. So I think I've told you I've been taking some courses from Neil Gaiman, learning about his creative process. I am absolutely loving that. I recently branched out and started going through Chris Hadfield's space exploration course, learning all kinds of science stuff. It's like going to science class that you really want to go to and love. I told you last time I got to learn about orbits and orbital mechanics, and I finally got it. I actually understood what was going on, and I always thought it would be kind of over my head. And that's another great thing, is they kind of have these bite-sized chunks. You can jump into a topic, a particular part of an overall course, just do one lesson. You can jump around, or you can go through the whole thing straight through. So with Gaiman's course, I'm kind of going straight through. With the Hadfield course, I'm kind of jumping into things that I have a little bit more interest in. And it's easy to do because they're put into these bite-sized chunks. You can access them on any of your devices, so iPhone, iPad, Mac, Apple TV, kind of my favorite way to do it. But you can pick up right where you left off, and they make it super easy. And they just have a massive variety of courses, whether you're looking for business stuff, you're looking for creative stuff, filmmaking, photography. You basically could use MasterClass as a way to learn how to make an entire film start to end, from development, screenwriting, business, marketing, all those sorts of things. They have all those classes in there, over 60 classes, and they're constantly adding more. I think having a MasterClass subscription is a great investment in your learning. And of course, you can get courses one-off, but I really think the biggest advantage to the program is having the all-access pass. And now you, as a MacCast listener, can get unlimited access to every MasterClass and get $30 off. I highly recommend you check it out. Get unlimited access to every MasterClass as a MacCast listener, and you'll get 15% off the annual all-access pass. Go to masterclass.com/maccast. That's masterclass.com/maccast for 15% off MasterClass. And a huge thank you to MasterClass for their support of the show. I put the call out to you last week for more feedback, more audio comments, and I have to say, you really did step it up, and I certainly appreciate it. I've always mentioned that the greatest thing I think about the MacCast is that it really did start out as this concept of a community show. Well, I should say, really, it didn't start out that way, because when I started podcasting in 2004, there wasn't much of a community. There was just a few of us. It was kind of a handful of folks. I was looking for a show about Macs and Apple, and because one didn't exist, I decided to start it. But it really did become a community show very quickly, because after the first episode, and to this day, I still don't know how this person found the show, because we didn't have a directory. We didn't have anything. I don't know where they found it. Maybe just a Google search, but somebody got a hold of the show and actually sent me a question. And I wasn't even doing a sort of community show at that point. Really, the concept was I was trying to do a summary each day. It was a daily show at that time of the news. It was kind of more like macOS Ken than the current MacCast you know and love. But what happened was I got that bit of feedback, and that made me realize that this really could be like a virtual user group in a lot of ways. And I was always a big fan of user groups. Those of you who've listened to the podcast for a long time know I'm deeply involved in my local user group here in San Diego. I do a lot of the presentations there. And it's a lot of what we do here on the MacCast, right? We try and help each other out. We answer questions and those sorts of things. So a big part of this is your feedback, you getting back to me with emails and audio comments, and I absolutely love that part of it. So this week we have a lot of stuff to follow up on and to talk about, and some great listener comments and questions and sort of stuff like that I'm going to share with you. So I'm super excited about this week's show. Starting off with one thing I was talking about last week was the App Store, App Store in iOS and iOS 13, and the fact that to make room for the new Apple Arcade tab, they had to move the Updates tab, and it is now sort of hidden in the interface. So you actually have to go into your user account. You kind of click on your little icon in the upper right-hand corner, and that's where you will find your software updates. Well, a few people chimed in and said, hey, there's some different things that you can find in there. Even though it's trickier, there are some quicker ways to get to it. Ian pointed out to me that if you use Taptic Touch or 3D Touch on the App Store icon, just tap and hold for a second, you'll get the menu pop up, and on there, you can literally slide your finger up to the updates option, and it will go right to the updates section. So in a lot of ways, one tap and slide. You could, of course, do two taps if you really want. But point is you can jump right there. So if you kind of forget where it is or don't know, try that little trick. And then Matt also pointed out that sometimes when you go in there, you won't see that there are any apps to update. But if you pull down, you do the typical pull to refresh option, kind of pull it and let it spring back up, it will refresh the updates and see if there are any more updates to pick up. And I actually had this happen to me. I popped open the updates with Ian's new trick and then discovered there was nothing in there. And I tried Matt's new trick, which is pull down, pull to refresh, and boom, I had several dozen actually apps waiting to be updated. So I don't know why it didn't update, but occasionally maybe things happen, it gets stuck, and you can manually refresh it that way. So there were some great tips there. The only other thing that I wanted to comment on somewhat related to this is I'm noticing not too many people are mentioning how much valuable sort of real estate in Apple's apps are being used up by things that I wouldn't consider necessarily functionality for everyone. So they're taking useful functionality like the updates tab and replacing it with things that are more about selling us stuff, trying to get us to buy into, say, an Apple Arcade subscription. Now, you know, I am a huge fan of Apple Arcade. I'm actually absolutely loving it. So I don't mind it because I use that tab. But I'm trying to think of those folks who aren't interested in Apple Arcade, right? It seems odd that Apple Arcade isn't its own separate app, something that once you subscribe to Apple Arcade, you get a separate thing. It's built into the App Store app, and it takes up a whole entire tab for a lot of people who maybe aren't even using it. And that's valuable real estate, and there's no option to kind of change that or adjust it. And we're seeing a very similar thing with things like Apple Music. And I talked about the Apple TV app, right? And the fact that Apple made recent changes with the addition of channels, and most of the stuff you get in the For You kind of Up Next section is about trying to get you to sign up for other services and making offers to you and selling stuff. And I get it. Apple is focusing on services revenue. They're moving post iPhone, and I understand it. But at the same time, I have to be honest and say it's a little bit frustrating. We're kind of getting the hard sell in a lot of ways, and it's impacting some of the useful features that we've had in the past, and we're not being given the options to sort of change that. So I've been thinking about that a little bit this week, and I'd be curious to know what your thoughts on that are. So if you want to shoot me an email, send me an audio comment. Remember, a great way to do it, and actually a lot of you took advantage of this option this week, is to just pop open the Voice Memos app on your iPhone, record a quick message, 1-2 minutes, maybe 3 minutes long, and send that off in an email, mattcast@gmail.com, and we'll have a little conversation about some of the things that are going on with Apple and some of the recent changes. Another thing that I had was monthly Apple Care. We talked about the fact that Apple is now offering the ability to, once your Apple Care has expired, go on a month-to-month plan. Well, Stephen had some questions about that program and how it worked, especially if you were already in Apple Care and you'd already paid for it. How did that work? And he wrote in and actually sent in an audio comment to share some information with us about that. So here's what Stephen found out.
Hi, Adam. It's Steve from Indiana. Longtime listener. Really appreciate all you do. I wanted to pass along something that I found out today, and I wanted to give it so that maybe your listeners, if they get into Apple Care with a new phone or watch or whatever, that they don't run into the same kind of problem. First of all, I got conflicting information from Apple and I have the confirmed information. And that confirmed information is you absolutely can buy your AppleCare agreements for the full 2 years all at once at the less expensive price because you're buying it all at once. And at the end of that, you will still have the opportunity to pay monthly for AppleCare beyond the 24 months. And so I just wanted to confirm that because I talked to a AppleCare senior advisor today about it, and she said, no, that's absolutely correct in what you can do. Number two is that if you haven't purchased yet or you haven't purchased your AppleCare, if you're doing it at the store, make sure the email you use, because a lot of times they just say, what email do you want to send the receipt to? But have the email you use be your AppleCare ID. Because what happens is if you're, especially if you're doing it monthly, is that that won't link to your iTunes sometimes because if your regular email isn't your Apple ID email. So number one is that you can get 24 months all at once, pay it once, and then still continue it. And number two is if you buy monthly AppleCare at the store, make sure you use your Apple ID as your email so that it goes through smoothly. Thanks. Take care.
Hey, thank you, Steve. Yeah, that's some great advice and some great information. So definitely appreciate you sharing that because this new program Apple's doing where you can either buy AppleCare month to month, paying monthly, pay a little bit more, or buy it up front. And then the fact that you can now extend it beyond the 2 years by paying and continuing to pay monthly, those are some great options. And definitely, I know folks often get into trouble with the mixed email thing too, having maybe an iCloud account that's different than your iTunes, Apple ID, AppleCare account. So just making sure all of that is all under the same email makes things a lot easier. And I've actually run into that problem because I've had situations where I've accidentally registered something. I have two. I have iTunes ID that I have from way back when, and I have a newer Apple iCloud ID, and I've mixed them up in the past. And getting that undone and getting things moved around, big pain in the butt. Much easier if you can take care of it up front. So some really great advice, and thank you for sending that in. Another thing that I commented on, I think this was on the last episode of the Maccast, we were talking about photos and the Photos application. I think more specifically about family share accounts with things like Apple Arcade and Apple TV and how all that process is going to work. And I think I mentioned that one feature that I keep waiting for Apple to put together is the concept of for family sharing a shared photo library. What I really want is just a single iCloud photo library that everybody in the family sort of participates in. So rather than each one of us having our own library, this would be a single library that we could share together. And I think I made more of an offhanded comment, but something that I was serious about the fact that at this point, I would even accept just a shared family album. Well, Daniel was very astute and emailed in and said, "Hey, Adam, you know, when you have a family shared account or a iCloud family sharing account, I think there is already a family shared album that is set up in your iCloud photo library if you set that up." And he's absolutely right. There is actually shared photos, and there has been shared photos for a while in the Photos app. You can turn them on by going into settings, your name. This is on your iOS device. So, go into settings, go into your name account, go into iCloud, go into Photos, and just turn on shared albums. And then you have the ability to create these shared albums and then invite people into those albums. And then everybody can, well, you can set it up in a number of different ways, but one of the ways you can set it up is everybody can add photos to that album and they get synced out to all of the other devices. So to create a new shared album and invite people, it makes it really pretty easy. And all the photos sync. And as Daniel pointed out, if you have family sharing enabled, I think the shared family album is kind of set up by default. And then each of the members in the family members in your family sharing account are automatically added to that album. I don't remember if it asks you if you want to set that up or not. I think it might, but you might have that already. And sure enough, Daniel, mine was in there. I probably need to start using that, considering the fact that I said that would be a feature that I would enjoy. So I'm going to start using it more. We had one photo in there. So at one point we had used it, but it was for only a single photo. Still, I think ultimately I would like a single shared library, family library, but we'll get there eventually. Another nice thing about the shared albums, and I didn't know this until I looked it up for this episode, those photos, yes, they are stored in iCloud, but they do not count against your iCloud storage limit. And more surprisingly, according to Apple's article, and I'd like to get some clarification on this because it sounds too good to be true, but according to their article, it says you can have up to 5,000 photos in and videos in a shared album. And they say a shared album. I'm thinking that's probably more all your shared albums, because I can't imagine that they would let you have albums with 5,000 photos unlimited that don't count against your iCloud, your paid iCloud storage. If that is the case, we might have a good loophole for getting a lot of online cloud storage, because you can create a shared album where you're the only person in that shared album. Maybe a trick. And so let's keep this to ourselves. Hopefully Apple doesn't hear this, because if this is the case, I don't want them to change it. Let's not have them shut that down. But let me know if you've played around with this and you have a lot of shared albums. Like I said, I haven't been using this feature. I actually have a few of them, but I only have a few photos in each album. And I've done them for different things. And I think if you're using iCloud Photo Library, there now is even a recommendation that comes up that'll recommend, hey, do you want to share this album with people? So it'll look at events like birthday parties or maybe parties that you go to and your friends that were at that party. And because if you have faces detection turned on, it can recognize who those friends are in those photos, and it'll recommend setting up a share for and inviting those folks from your contact list. It's actually pretty cool. Again, that's built into iCloud Photo Library. The photo sharing feature, the shared albums feature, you just have to have an iCloud account. This is not at all related to iCloud Photo Library. It's actually a separate thing. So that's kind of what I'm saying, is you can have this iCloud album with up to 5,000 photos and maybe unlimited albums through this sharing feature. So that's pretty neat. And thank you, Daniel, for reminding me that I already have access to that feature. So that's some of the great follow-up that was sent in from the last episode of the MacCast. Let's keep it going. If you have additional feedback for me, if you have questions or comments, you know where to send it, maccast@gmail.com. As we mentioned at the very top of the show, macOS Catalina is out officially now, and I jumped on board day one, believe it or not. I never do this. You, longtime listeners of the show, know that I don't do this. I normally am very cautious. I wait. My computer is a production computer. I do not recommend that anybody follow me. This is not an endorsement for doing this. I don't know what came over me. I was just feeling kind of brave. I wanted to see some of the new features, and I just went for it. Now, when I say went for it, you know that I went for it in a very MacCast way, right? Backup, backup, backup. I say it. It's my mantra. I have tons of backup. So I was not too worried about it. Well, I say not too worried in the same breath that I'm going to tell you, I made additional backups right before I did the install. I checked and verified my Carbon Copy Cloner backup. I ran a fresh version of it, made sure that that happened and was successful and that I could recover files from it. I double-checked my Time Machine backups, so I knew I had two local backups already. I also double-checked and made sure my Backblaze offsite backup had run recently. That had run recently, so it was like check, 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 backup, backup, backup. I had my three. I knew I was ready to go. I also created a USB recovery disk. The way you do this is you actually download the update from the App Store. So I downloaded the Catalina update, but when it launched and went into the installer, I quit out of that. That will leave the installer in your applications folder. And then you can create a USB recovery disk using the create install media command in your terminal. Apple actually has a support article on how to do this. I will link to it in the show notes at maccast.com. And you can create your own account. Now, you do need to run the command using sudo. If you don't know what that means, it's basically a way to escalate your privileges to that of an admin. So you are going to need to have your admin username and password for your Mac to be able to do it. But you can create a USB recovery key. And I've done this for every Mac install. Because Apple doesn't include physical media anymore, you can create your own on a USB stick. So did that. So I had my backups. I had my recovery disk in case something went totally wrong. And I ran the installer. One nice thing about Catalina, because a big change is that it is supporting only 64-bit apps. So if you have older 32-bit apps, they're not going to work. Well, one nice thing that Catalina did when I ran the installer was it gave me a warning message about the apps on my system that were no longer going to work. And in my case, it was three of them. Levelator, which is an awesome program that I am sorely going to miss. QuickTime 7. Yes, I still ran QuickTime 7 because it has all the editing features. It's so much better than QuickTime 10. But QuickTime 7, that's gone. So that was a lamented loss on my part too. And then an old Adobe application manager that I didn't really care about. So those were my three. So I knew I was pretty good. I think this is a great thing because there's some people that probably don't realize the number of older apps that they have on their system that might not run when they upgrade. And that could give you pause or at least give you time and a reminder to say, hey, go out and check your apps, make sure they're all going to run. Don't lose your critical data or access to your critical programs. So that was I'm giving Apple a good job on that one. And then I did run the installer. I just ran an over-the-top install. Again, longtime listeners to the MacCast know that I am a big fan of doing clean installs every few years. I actually did a full clean install for macOS Mojave, and my machine had been running very well, so I didn't feel like there was going to be any issues just doing an over-the-top installation. Famous last words, though, right? Because here's what happened to me, and those of you who follow me on Twitter probably know this. I started the install. It got about maybe a fifth of the way with the status bar saying estimating time remaining, and then it kind of stuck there, and I thought, that's interesting. Let me wait a little bit longer. I waited for over an hour. It did not move one bit. And that's when I started freaking out, going, this is not a good sign. But as you know, I'm all about patience and waiting. I think very often when things look like they're stuck, they're not. And just having a little bit of patience is an okay thing. And so I decided to sleep on it. It was pretty late. It was, you know, early, getting into the early morning. And I thought, you know, I'm going to leave it here. I'm going to go to bed. It'll either be done when I wake up or it won't. Nothing I can do about it now, right? And this is the thing, is like I could either stayed up all night, probably tried rebooting it, maybe screwed up the installation, caused a problem, and then had to start from scratch, or just go to bed, sleep on it, wake up. And when I woke up, I was greeted with a beautiful, gorgeous image of Catalina Island on my screen. So I knew it had worked. I then proceeded to start the wizard and started setting up my Mac with the operating system, and it got to the option to enable screen time. I'm a big fan of screen time. I said, yeah, turn that on. I want to have that. And then it froze. It hung on screen time setup. And there were actually a lot of reports of people having Catalina sort of hang at startup. And I knew from those that most people said, don't worry about it, just do a hard reboot, it will be fine. And so I did that. I did have to do a hard reboot, and I had to go back in and manually set up screen time after the fact. But everything seemed to work after that. After the reboot, no real big issues that I noticed. As far as using the operating system day to day, it feels mostly the same. Of course, there's those nice little enhancements, the biggest change being the breakup of iTunes into iTunes and the Finder, plus the three apps, the TV app, the podcast app, and the music app. I'm getting a lot of feedback from many of you who aren't really thrilled with the user interface on those. Frankly, I don't do a lot of syncing. I think where the line is being drawn, if I can sort of read into the community here, is that those folks who use Apple Music, who get their podcasts directly through the podcast app, who maybe, you know, get their content through the TV app but are streaming, people who tend to stream more stuff, this isn't a really big change. For those of you who still are doing the connect and sync, it's kind of a big deal. And I have to say, I agree. I've popped into the various apps, and the user interface is, I think it's not great. You know, it's okay. It's nice. It looks very Apple-esque, but it is a pretty big change. And there are a few little issues. I tried directly connecting my iPhone to kind of see what the experience was like using iPhone in the Finder. It worked a little bit the first time I connected. I had to give it permissions to, of course, access my iPhone. I had to say a couple times, yes, I want you to be able to access the iPhone. It popped up in the Finder. So you bring up a Finder window, and under locations, your phone shows up. And then when you click on that, and I would assume the same is for an iPad, you click on it, and then it looks like iTunes, or basically like the iTunes interface in the Finder. You have the different tabs for general music, movies, TV shows, podcasts, audiobooks, books, photos, files, and info. You can do your backups. You can do your software updates. You can choose to sync your stuff and set up your syncing options. So it pretty much works exactly the same when it works, at least for me. So what happened for me is I connected it, and then boom, my iPhone disconnected suddenly. And then it started connecting and disconnecting and connecting and disconnecting. I tried rebooting the phone. I tried rebooting the Mac. I was still having the same problem. I think for me, what it might have come down to was I have an iPhone 11, and I've noticed that it seems to require more power. And I have an older 2015 MacBook Pro. I think the USB ports, one on either side, I think one has a little less power, and the port that I was plugged into just wasn't giving enough power to the phone. And so that was causing it to sort of cycle from doing charging to not charging, charging to not charging, and that caused my problem. So I just moved it over, connected it to a hub, and I did have to reboot the phone again. But once I did that, it does seem to be working reliably. But it feels like there's some growing pains. And same sort of thing with the apps. Somebody pointed out to me the locations for the storage. Because when we had iTunes, everything in the one iTunes library, you could put your storage location on an external volume. And that still is the case in macOS Mojave for the TV app, your TV shows and videos, and your iTunes music, or what's now your music in the music app. So your local music, your local movies, your local TV shows can still exist on an external drive. And within each of those applications, you can define that location. That is not the case for audiobooks or podcasts. When you launch the books application, it will ask you or tell you more directly that it's going to find all of your audiobooks and move those into the books application. And it puts those onto your internal drive in a special location that is somewhat hidden. And that's the same thing for podcasts. So for podcasts, those are going to get stored in a cache folder, in your home folder, in the library folder, in a folder called group containers, in this sort of cryptic folder that's .groups.com.apple.podcasts. And then for books, it's a very similar situation. It's in your home folder, in the library folder, in containers, in com.apple.bk.agentservice. And then inside there, in a folder called data, inside a folder called documents, inside a folder called iBooks, inside a folder called books. And that's where you'll find all your books. Audiobooks are also in there in that documents folder. So, and I think in a folder called audiobooks. So if you can find it, great. The problem is that if you don't have a lot of storage on your internal drive and you have a lot of audiobooks, this could potentially be a problem. So hopefully that is something that Apple will change in the near future, that they will give us the ability within those apps, because they are new apps on the Mac, the ability within those apps to actually define the media storage location and to define that as an external volume. But for right now, it is not working like that. But overall, you know, the applications are okay. I think they're going to develop, right? We have to remember this is kind of like version one. A lot of us have been demanding, asking for the breakup of iTunes for a long time. A lot of people really hated iTunes. So it's going to be interesting to see, you know, are people happier with this, or are we going to regret it a little bit and wish we had our iTunes back? So far from the community, the feedback that I've been getting from you, it feels mixed. It feels about 50-50, and I think the split does divide along the lines that I told you about. Like, if you are syncing on your devices and just doing everything directly in the apps on your devices, I think you're going to be probably pretty happy with this switch. If you're more reliant on iTunes day-to-day and kind of connecting and syncing things, it is going to be a little bit of growing pains, I think, for you. So just prepare yourself for that. And if you're not interested in it, yeah, maybe you want to stick with macOS Mojave for a while longer before you consider upgrading to Catalina. So a lot of people have been asking me, you know, do I upgrade? Do I not upgrade? I think it really comes down to the type of person you are. You know, are you interested in change and dealing with that change and working through it right away? Then fine, maybe upgrade to macOS Catalina, because it does have some nice new features. But if that's not the type of person you are, maybe wait a little bit longer. And especially, again, don't follow my lead. If you rely on your Mac day in, day out for critical business stuff, get to a point where you're ready to upgrade, where you're happy with the knowledge that all your apps are going to work. You know, you might want to wait a few months. Let the rest of us sort of sort out the bugs and deal with the little issues and stuff like that. Because there have been a few little issues, but nothing major. I said, overall, I did not really notice the change. I'm using my Mac the same way I was pre-macOS Catalina, and everything seems to be working fine, with the exception of those few applications. But I just switched, you know, like instead of Levelator, I am using Rogue Amoeba's Fission, which I already had and use for some of my production workflow, and I'm using the Normalize feature in there to kind of deal with some of the things that Levelator was doing. Now, Levelator, I think, did a little bit more, but it's going to work for now, and maybe at some point someone will rewrite that application. I don't know. I don't even know if the source code's been open sourced for it, but that's here nor there. Point is, if you're thinking about upgrading, just be aware of the changes with applications and know before you upgrade that your apps that you need are going to work and work reliably. Because I think I also saw there were some issues with some audio applications. There often are because of audio drivers and certain things. And also Photoshop, I think, has a tiny little issue that could impact some people. So if you're a photographer, you might want to look into that as well. But overall, I am enjoying it so far. Another little thing to point out, because some people ask me about this, and I noticed this on my own Mac as well. Right after I upgraded, there was a folder on my desktop called Relocated Items. And I thought, oh, that's weird. What is that? And if you click into it, there's a little README file in there. But basically what it is that it'll tell you during the last macOS upgrade or file migration, some of your files couldn't be moved to their new locations. And there's a couple reasons for that. One that it identifies is security files. So files that were in a certain location on the old operating system that is now incompatible with the new operating system from a security standpoint, those will be in this folder. And then also configurations. So if you had modified any kind of system level configurations that were not compatible with the new operating system, those configurations are saved and moved into this folder. So in my case, an example of this is I run MySQL Server and Apache Server for my web development work on my Mac. I install that myself manually. I tweak the Apache configuration file. I have my own MySQL databases and all that sort of stuff. So some of those files were actually moved into this relocated items folder. So if you're wondering what that is, if you see this on your desktop, that's what it's all about. And you can read me the, and you can read that README file, that README PDF that's in there to learn a little bit more about it. As far as how macOS Catalina is working for me, I have to say overall, I think it's running a little bit more reliably for me than even macOS Mojave did. Specifically, I had this issue with some of my external drives, and I actually had this for years. I had this with Sierra, High Sierra, macOS Mojave, where this one drive in particular would just unmount and remount constantly. That seems to have mostly gone away with this upgrade. So knock on wood, I'm hoping that's a little bit better. Performance seems great. Haven't run into too many issues. And overall, I am really liking it. I haven't had a chance to dig into a lot of the new features, but I have been reading about a few of them. And there were a couple that I wanted to point out to you because I think they're pretty cool. One little change is, you know, the little stoplight icons, the red close icon, the yellow minimize icon, and the green maximize icon. There's a new feature on that little green icon where if you take your cursor and you sort of hover over it for a second, it will give you a drop-down menu, and it will give you the option to go into full screen mode, to tile your window to the left of your screen, to tile the window to the right of your screen, and if you have multiple monitors, to move the window to another monitor. So that's a nice little handy drop down. The whole tile window thing is very reminiscent of split screen on the iPad. And when you tile it, what it'll do is it'll push the current window over to one side or the other, and then it will show you kind of in an expose view all of the other open windows that you have, and you can select one of those, and it will put that in the other side of the split screen. So a little kind of window screen management tool built in that is pretty neat. Another thing is in Safari, there is a ability to search for tabs. So if you're the type of person who has like a million tabs open, the universal URL and search bar, so where you would normally do a Google search or a or put in your URL, when you type in there, it will also search through and show you any open tabs that match that content. I think it just searches for the title of the page. It might go a little bit deeper, but it will give you the option to switch to that tab right in the search results. So that can be pretty handy. So a couple cool little features that I've noticed that haven't been talked about too much. Like I said, I've only been running it for a few days now. I haven't had a chance to really dig into a lot of the new features. And because I run an older Mac, one of the big features that a lot of people are talking about, which is Sidecar, the ability to use your iPad as kind of another screen or a mirrored screen that you can actually use Apple Pencil or Touch to interact with your Mac with. My machine doesn't support that. My MacBook Pro is a 2015, and you pretty much need a 2016 or newer device. So I haven't been able to play around with that, so I can't give you an opinion on it. But maybe someone in the community can. If you have been using Sidecar, what do you think about it? Do you like it? Do you not like it? Let us know. So there's that. And then the only other thing I had for you on Catalina was that I did read there's one feature that is not coming to Catalina anytime soon, despite the fact that Apple had sort of showed it off and announced it at their event. And that's iCloud Drive folders. And this is a feature that I was kind of excited about because it's the Dropbox-like feature where you can actually take a folder, put it into iCloud, and then share that. So it would be synced between everybody who is sharing that folder. Apple had originally said on their website that it was going to be available later this fall. This week, they changed the text on their site to say coming this spring. So it looks like it's delayed several months. We are going to get it eventually, but not for a while. So unfortunately, you're not going to have that. You're going to have to use alternatives. Luckily, we have Dropbox. It's a great alternative. I've used it for years. But it will be nice when Apple actually brings that feature to the Mac. Now, there is a lot of nice new things inside Catalina. I do have to share with you, though, one that is kind of driving me a little bit crazy. Something you'll notice probably almost immediately after you upgrade, because it's a little bit annoying. And what I'm talking about, if you haven't figured it out already, are the permission pop-ups. They are coming up everywhere. And while I appreciate the fact that the reason they're here is because Apple is trying to make sure that we're being aware of our security and privacy. They're letting us know what apps are doing, what they're trying to do on our Mac, what's happening in the background. But I can tell you almost every app that I launch triggers one of these little pop-ups. And my concern is that when this happens, we get pop-up fatigue, right? You don't necessarily read or pay attention to what is popping up. And I'm just going to caution folks, don't fall into that trap. Also, you know, read the message and sort of understand what that message means. And I've had to do some Googling. I will be honest with you. These messages are popping up and I am wondering what's going on. And actually, Keith also noticed these messages and was wondering what was going on with one of them in particular. So he sent in this question.
Hey, Adam, this is Keith. I have a question in regard to the recent iOS update to 13. I noticed that when I open up apps after having been updated, it popped up with this new message that I don't recall ever seeing before. But it said, it would say, this is what the message says. It says, quotation, whatever app it is that you're opening, would like to use Bluetooth. This will allow whatever app that you open to find and connect to the Bluetooth accessories. This app may also use Bluetooth to know when you're nearby. Then, of course, the to allow or don't allow. But I guess in the past, we had the, you know, it just the app automatically used the Bluetooth. I guess I'm not exactly sure why this notification is popping up. And, you know, do we need to allow it to? So, for example, if I download an app that is an audio app, if I put don't allow, will I still be able to listen through my Bluetooth headphones? Or do I have to hit yes, okay? Does it still work within the system? You know, I'm a little bit confused as to why that notification is popping up in this recent update. Thank you, Adam.
Hey, Keith, we'll try and help you out. Yeah, I found the message completely confusing, too. And I think part of the problem is, one, it seems to pop up with a lot of apps, which is a little bit shocking, right? To consider the number of apps that are requesting Bluetooth access and the number of apps that you would think they don't need Bluetooth access. Like, what are you doing with the Bluetooth? And that message isn't always clear. Now, it's up to the developer to kind of implement that. I think there's like a default message, which is the message that you just read. They can put in there specifically why they're asking for Bluetooth access. They can say, you know, we need to connect to a certain device, or we need to use it for casting. And that is a lot of what's going on here. Well, there's a couple scenarios. So I think one of your questions was, you know, what is it asking permissions for? Like, what is it doing? And it's going to vary from app to app. And so it's a little bit hard to answer that question, but I'll do my best because there's kind of various categories, as you might imagine. So a lot of apps, the ones where they're more confusing, you're like, why does this pizza app or why does this retail app like Macy's app or a Kohl's app, why does this want access to my Bluetooth? And if it's a store app or that kind of app, it's probably more related to location tracking, because what you can do with Bluetooth, and this can happen in the background even when you're not running the app, is they can track your location with physical beacons. little Bluetooth things that they put inside retail stores, maybe at various points, maybe at certain displays, where they could potentially detect that and pop up offers to you, and those sorts of things. So a lot of those apps, that's the kind of application that they're asking for Bluetooth permission for, and that's where that part of the message that talks about, hey, this could be used to track your location, that's what that is all about. Other apps need it for specific functionality connecting to maybe a dedicated accessory. So, for example, I have a Sphero, which is a little ball, remote controlled ball, you know, like that you can control with an iPhone app. That connects via Bluetooth, so it needs to be able to connect with that. Or I have an automatic, which is a adapter that plugs into the diagnostic port on my car and allows me to track my mileage and my driving habits and tracks where I go, and that links to my phone through Bluetooth. So those two applications, obviously, I need to enable this feature. I need to allow it so that they can continue to function. And then some audio and video apps might want it for casting, the ability to transmit the audio to some sort of device. And when I say casting, think about something like a Chromecast, a non-AirPlay device, a non-Bluetooth device, because I think another one of your questions was, do I need to enable this in all of my apps to be able to use my Bluetooth headphones or to use my AirPods or to be able to connect to a Bluetooth speaker? And the answer there is no, you do not need to do that, because that is handled by the Bluetooth audio communication in the underlying operating system itself. So iOS 13 is going to take care of that. And I did verify this. I took some of my apps that I had allowed because I did think I needed to allow it for Bluetooth access for headphones. So say like the CW app, that asked for permission for my Bluetooth. I don't know why. I'm presuming now it was for things like Chromecast. If I want to cast to a Chromecast, it would need Bluetooth access for that, because I think that's how it sets up the initial handshake. But for standard Bluetooth audio, for connecting to Bluetooth headphones and things like that, you do not need to enable it. So I think overall, hopefully this explains some of the why and how. The sort of, you know, what should you do question when you see this pop-up, I think my tactic for now is the same across all of these pop-ups. So the Bluetooth one is just one of them. I've seen several others, you know, hey, this app is using your location. I think we talked about that on a previous episode of the MacCast. Any of these pop-ups, hey, this the app wants to send you notifications. Hey, this app wants to do this. Hey, this app wants to do that. All really annoying, like I said, but I think more and more, our default posture, the default answer should mostly be no. You can always go back and change these things later if you find out that there's some sort of functionality in the app that isn't working. But I think what you'll find most of the time when you say no is that all of the app's core functions still work. It does what you need it to do. A lot of this stuff is being enabled so that, frankly, they can track us. They can make offers to us. They can market to us in some sort of way. And you probably want these features off most of the time. I will tell you, for like geolocation stuff, I almost always will try and figure out why does this app need my location? And if there's a legitimate reason, I'll usually say, okay, you can use it while I'm using the app. I want to know that, okay, I've popped open Yelp. I want to get some Yelp reviews for restaurants that are around me. Fine, go ahead and use my location at this moment, because that's okay. Do I want Yelp constantly in the background using my location? Absolutely not. There's no reason they need to be tracking me when I'm not actively using the app. So I would say default posture, say no. You can always change it later. It's easy to do. You go into settings, you go into privacy, you go into location, or you go into Bluetooth, or whatever permissions you want to give an app, you know, permissions to access the audio, permissions to access your photos, all these sorts of things. And you can turn it back on if you find there's some functionality missing from your apps. But, you know, I think as annoying as all these pop-ups are, what they're dealing with is the overreaching that so many apps are doing with our permissions. They're just grabbing everything that they can, getting access to everything that they can without any rhyme or reason, just because they can, not because they should. And this is our way to control it. And so we're going to have to deal with some of these annoyances. Don't get pop-up fatigue. You know, make sure you read those messages. Make sure, like you did, Keith, you reach out and you understand what's going on. And so hopefully this helped you out. And we'll continue to share this sort of information on future episodes of the MacCast. But, you know, that's a long-winded way to say there's one part of Catalina that I'm finding a little bit annoying, and it's these little pop-ups and stuff like that. But that's kind of my first impressions and experiences installing and using Catalina. Of course, we'll have a lot more information as I dig in and use it more, as you dig in and use it more. So another thing that I'm going to put a call out to the community for is send us your discoveries in Catalina. Let us know what you're liking about it. Let us know what you're not liking about it. And especially if you find a really cool tip or trick related to something in Catalina, share it with us. Send us an audio comment, maccast@gmail.com. Another thing that's come up in the MacCast community lately is Apple Watch. You know, Apple released a new Apple Watch Series 5. It's not all that different from a Series 4. So a lot of people have been commenting, myself included, that it doesn't seem like if you're a Series 4 owner or maybe even a Series 3 owner, that there's a lot of compelling reason to upgrade. Well, listener Tim, who is also a great fellow podcaster, Tim Chatton, he's been around in the community for a long time, he just upgraded from a Series 4 to a Series 5, and he wanted to share his experiences with us. So he sent in this little review, and I thought it was great. So here's what Tim had to say about Apple Watch 5, Series 5.
Hey, Adam. Tim here, host of the iPad Pros podcast and launching soon with Oceanhorn 2, the Apple Arcade Plus podcast, where I interview Apple Arcade game creators. I want to share some thoughts on the Series 5 after using it for the past week or so. I'm coming from the Series 4 and managed to sell that watch enough to make the upgrade cost me only a little more than $100, which was worth it for me for that always-on display. Ever since the watch got cellular capabilities, I've been a really huge fan of the device and what it offers. I'm someone that frequently leaves the phone behind during the day and at night to go watch only. The always-on display for me is just as game-changing as the addition of cellular. Being able to glance down as I'm typing and seeing the time and complications is just remarkable. The display is much brighter than I would have anticipated, and love this always-on display mode so much that I turned off Raise to Wake, which makes it feel more like a watch as it's constant in what the display is showing me unless I myself am telling it to do something different. It puts me in complete control of when the watch goes into that full power mode by either twisting the crown or tapping the screen, and the notifications don't pop up when I don't want them to or don't expect them to, which is really nice. With Raise Wake off, I'm also getting substantially better battery life than I was with my Series 4, where I would have Raise Wake on. I'm finding I end most days in the 40 to 50% battery range, and that includes days where I do a 30-minute workout with just my watch and headphones. I can even be on cellular away from my phone for 3.5 hours or so each day and hit that 40 to 50% range at the end of the day. On especially busy days where I'm working at projects at home, I'll end the day at 65 to 75% range as the watch is more in the standby mode connected to the Bluetooth to my phone. I did run a watch-only test where the watch would be connected to either Wi-Fi or cellular all day long and never interacting with the phone over Bluetooth. And they made it until 9:15 p.m. where I started the day at 6:40 a.m. It lost around 4% per hour when connected to cellular and 3% per hour when connected to Wi-Fi. And this is just in standby mode being available to receive calls and iMessages. What really killed it that day was when I needed to use the web browser of the watch through Siri and find some information over cellular with an extended browsing session. It's amazing that you can do this and browse the web on your watch, but it is very battery intensive still, and remember similar battery drains when I tried to do this on the Series 4 as well. So this type of use is possible, but would have to be lighter days or you're charging it while you're working at your desk midday. One thing that has changed with the always-on display are complications. You really change the ones you use when it is information you can see at all times. The biggest change here is I'm now using the messages complication almost all the time. The complication will update to indicate how many messages are unread. One side benefit to this is I've turned off notifications for all but the most vital message threads and muted the others. With always on, I'm glancing down enough to see when a new message comes in, and I'm getting disrupted less because of this more glanceable information that I didn't trust I'd see on older watches. I'd love to see Apple Mail get this kind of complication for VIPs so I can know when I should check email rather than needing a notification for the information. I do hope we see some updates to Always On to include third-party apps to work in this mode, and I especially would like to see Apple Maps work with this so I can just glance down while I'm driving to see the next turn. This sort of works with the Siri watch face, but the update time isn't fast enough to be that practical. The Workouts app is great in this mode and hope it extends to other apps. The other thing I hope comes is better complication support. I was so excited when we got the cellular complication this year with watchOS 6, but in Always On display mode, that complication will either disappear completely when connected to cellular or turn into a generic gray circle when not connected. So as a result, I'm not using one of the complications I was most excited for with this year's watchOS update. In general, I'm using watch faces that look identical in both modes, and this includes complications. And overall, I'm very happy with the experience, but hope watchOS 7 or 6.5 maybe can address some of these implementation details. The final thing I just want to mention is that there seems to be a partition on the watch to only allow you to sync over 8 GB of music onto your 32 GB watch, which has 26.9 GB of usable storage. Apparently the limit was 4 GB on the Series 4, but with the extra space on the watch, I'm especially noticing that because there is more of a buffer and feels like maybe 12 GB will be more appropriate for the music partition. I guess I'll have plenty of room for Audible and the podcasts and the Outcast app, but it would be nice to have more music on board. So there are some of my thoughts on the Series 5. I am loving it and can't wait to see where the watch goes from here. It's one of my favorite platforms and was super excited when I found a buyer that made it doable for me to upgrade this year. I hope these comments have been helpful. Really love the MacCast. Keep up the great work, Adam.
Hey, Tim, thank you. And thank you very much for the thorough and great review of the Apple Watch Series 5. You almost made me want to upgrade, but I'm not going to go there. I can't justify the cost. I'm still in a Series 2, and I'm perfectly happy with it. Someday, though, I will get into a new Apple Watch, maybe with the Series 6. But some very compelling information in that, and I appreciate you sending that along. This week, we also had Danny, who needs a little bit of help with Apple Watch. He had a question, and I'll just let him ask.
Hey, Adam, this is Danny from Los Angeles. I've been a MacCast listener for a couple years now, and I wanted to call in about an issue I've been having with my Apple Watch Series 3 since upgrading it last week to watchOS 6. So one thing to explain, I'm one of those people who have two Apple IDs. I had an original Apple ID that I had set up a long time ago when I first started using iTunes, even before the App Store, way back, a long time ago. And then later on, basically had a second one created when I first started using MobileBee, which then became iCloud, which became like a whole separate thing. Always maintained the two separate Apple IDs, asked Apple at one point if I should try to merge them. They didn't really recommend it. And it's generally been fine. You always have to kind of tweak the settings when you're setting up a new device to accommodate the two IDs, but not really a problem. After doing this update to my watch, I noticed that I keep getting a message asking for the password for the Apple ID that is for the iTunes and the App Store, so not the one that I mainly use for normal iCloud activity. And I went through the process. You could enter it from your phone. It said it was okay. Then it basically told me on the watch it was going to send me a two-factor authentication code to all of my devices, except none of my devices are set up to receive a two-factor authentication for that Apple ID. They're set up to receive them for my iCloud Apple ID if I was trying to log into the iCloud account from a Mac or an iPad or an iPhone, then they would go off and they would be fine. But I've never really had to put one in. I assume, for one thing, that this is supposed to happen. But more importantly, I can't figure out how to authenticate it. So now my watch still functions, but it basically just keeps flashing the prompt for the password to the point that it's, I wouldn't say unusable, but it's really more of a nuisance to have on my wrist than not, and we'll probably just be leaving it home on the charger until I can figure out a way around this. I didn't know if you had any suggestions or any anything you've seen like this before. But thank you so much. Really enjoy the podcast. Thanks. Bye-bye.
Hey, Danny, that is something we don't want you doing. We don't want you leaving your Apple Watch at home because you can't get logged into your account. So we're going to try and help you out. I haven't directly run into this myself. I've kind of seen things happen in and around this. So I'm going to give you my best guesses as to possibilities as to what might be happening. I don't have a definitive answer for you, but maybe someone in the community will. So between myself and this great community we have here, I think we can get you sorted and you can continue to wear your Apple Watch. So my first thought when I received your message was check your iTunes Apple ID and see if two-factor authentication is even turned on for it, or maybe it's using the older two-step verification, which is a little bit different. And then if it is turned on, verify what, if any, devices. I know you said that there weren't any devices really registered to that. Maybe there is one, or maybe you can get one registered. I don't really know. So you would do this from your Apple ID account. So if you go to appleid.apple.com and log in with that iTunes Apple ID, just kind of check it out. Go into the settings and the preferences in there and see how that account is set up. So that might be one option. The other thing to know is that you can get the 6-digit code, that verification code, on any of your devices manually. Now, I don't know if this will work if the Apple ID isn't registered to that device, but I guess in a way it technically is, because if you're using it, say, for your iTunes and your Apple Music, it should be on that device. So this may work to actually get the code manually, even if it isn't sending it as a registered device. You can go into settings and tap on your Apple ID at the top and then tap on password and security. And then you'll see a link that says get verification code. Tap on that and it will generate a verification code right on the device. Almost like opening up, say, like the Google Authenticator app. It's, you know, I kind of equate it to Apple's version of that. It's a way to generate one of these codes on the fly when you need it. And maybe when you're not connected in a way where you can actually get the code from Apple. So it may work in this case. I know you said it's popping up for your, it sounds like, iTunes ID. I'm wondering if there's possibly any third-party apps on your watch that might be the thing that is triggering that, asking for Apple ID or iCloud syncing. And sometimes with third-party apps, for the login, you need to use an app-specific password. I'll have a link to information about this in the show notes at maccast.com, but there is a way to go into your Apple ID account and generate an Apple app-specific password for your Apple ID. And sometimes that can work around this issue of constantly popping up. So what's happening is it's trying to use your regular Apple credentials, and what it really needs is a app-specific password. And then kind of related to that first question, you know, is this account using the older two-step verification method? There is a trick for that, too. If you have older devices and it's using two-step verification and it asks for the security code, usually there's no place to enter it in on the device. And so what you have to do is actually append the security code to the end of your password in the password field. So you do your login like normal, you put your username, you put your password, and then you enter the 4-digit security code on the end of the password field, and then it will accept the login. So that might be another thing to try. Again, I feel like I'm grabbing at straws a little bit because I don't know really what is triggering this in your case, but maybe between one of those things that'll work, or maybe someone in the community will have an answer for us. But regardless, we'll get you sorted, and thanks for sending in your question. I like a good mystery now and then. Do you like mysteries? I like mysteries. I like puzzles. I play a lot of puzzle games. Things like Myst. I absolutely loved the game Myst and all the games like that. The Room, the entire Room series, I'm big on. So I like to try and figure out mysteries. And this week, Matt gave me a pretty big mystery about an odd bug he discovered in iPadOS in iOS 13. If you're using restrictions, parental controls in screen time, you can have your Apple TV app go missing. And you might not realize why. So what Matt discovered was he was trying to turn on the restriction for deleting apps on his son's iPhone or iPad. I guess this is iPad only. This is iPadOS on iOS 13. So if you go into settings, go into screen time, and go into the content and privacy restrictions, and then under iTunes and App Store purchases, set the deleting apps option to don't allow, what will happen is the TV app on your home screen will disappear. It will literally go away, which is odd. And the first time I tried this, I had my TV app in a folder, and mine didn't disappear, but Matt had said his on the home screen did. So I tried moving mine to the home screen and repeating this process, and boom, sure enough, the app disappeared. What's weird is once it disappeared the first time, then even moving it back into a folder and enabling this deleting apps don't allow option in the privacy restrictions, that still removed the TV app from my device. And when I would turn that don't allow back to allow, the TV app would pop into not the folder that it was in, but it would drop right back onto my main home screen. So this is definitely some sort of weird bug. I don't know why it's happening. The other thing that happened is once I was able to enable the bug, anytime that I would turn the don't allow option on in the screen time content privacy restriction settings, it would crash my settings to the Springboard. So not only would the TV app disappear, but it would also completely crash my settings app to the Springboard, which was just weird. And unfortunately, this was not fixed in iOS 13.1.2, which came out this past week. So hopefully this is a bug that Apple is aware of. It's kind of an obscure one, but it is really pretty interesting, so I wanted to share it, because it's amazing, Matt, that you even found this bug or even noticed it. I don't know that I would have noticed it. I guess I would have noticed it when my TV app was missing, but I probably wouldn't have been able to connect the two together. So another reason I wanted to share this is if you suddenly notice that your TV app is gone, it could be related to this bug. So thank you for sharing that with us, Matt. I appreciate it. All right, last thing that I want to talk to you about is kind of a cool new feature in Shortcuts in iOS 13, something that you can play around with pretty easily, especially if you have an Apple Card. And this was something that was talked about at the announcement of iOS 13, and it is the support for NFC, reading NFC tags. And you can now inside Shortcuts, if you have an iPhone that supports passive NFC reading, trigger events and trigger Shortcuts to happen when they read an NFC tag. And so this will work on iPhone XR and iPhone XS series or newer phones. If you have an older phone like an iPhone 8 or anything older than that, those don't support this passive reading feature. They do support active reading, right, for things like Apple Pay, but you have to have the wallet app open. You have to like actively be scanning. So this won't really work for those devices. The idea here is that you can take your phone, just pass it over an NFC tag, and some sort of event will happen. And the way you use this inside the Shortcuts app is you, of course, have to have access to an NFC tag. I think you can actually buy them like on Amazon. I've heard people just getting random ones. And so you have to have an NFC tag. And then in Shortcuts, you tap on the automation tab at the bottom, and then you'll see an option for create personal automation. And under settings, you pick NFC, and then when you add the NFC, it will give you the opportunity to scan the tag that you want to use as the trigger for the automation. And once you've scanned it, then you can just simply add actions and events for what you want to have happen when your phone comes near that NFC tag. And like I said, you can try this out with your Apple Card, because the Apple Card, when you activate it, right, you hold your phone next to it, and that's because, or next to the little folder it came in. So if you still have that folder, that has a NFC tag embedded in it. And now it will still trigger the default, you know, authorize my card option, but your card will already be authorized, so that's fine. It'll give you the little message, but it will also trigger your shortcut. So you can scan in that tag, you can add some events, and see what it's like to trigger a shortcut with an NFC tag. Pretty cool, right? So I set this up with the personal, in the personal automation section. What I had it do was just simply say a message and turn on a light. And it totally worked. It was a lot of fun to play around with. And that's pretty cool to be able to trigger a shortcut with an NFC tag. Not only that, though, if you're playing around in this personal automation section in Shortcuts, which is new, there are a few other triggers and options that could be pretty handy. I won't go through all of them, but some of them that I saw immediately that I might start playing around with are things like when you stop an alarm. So imagine in the morning, right, you have your alarm set, you hit stop, you could have a bunch of actions happen. So you could have it go out to your favorite weather app, get the weather. You could have it go out to your favorite news app, maybe start up your favorite podcast, all those sorts of things right when you tap the stop alarm button. I would think that maybe you could even have it start up your favorite podcast and play it on a Bluetooth speaker or a HomePod that's nearby, which is pretty cool. There is something in there. There's a trigger called when you're about to leave for your commute. That one I can't figure out how that works, because it's something like, hey, 5 minutes before I leave for my commute, do a bunch of things. How does it know when I'm going to leave work? That one I can't quite figure out. I'm assuming it's using travel patterns and times, but I leave work at different times every day. So how is it going to do 15 minutes before? I might play around with this one. If you've played around with it, let me know. But I can't imagine that it would be super reliable, but maybe. There's also a trigger for like when you connect to CarPlay. So if you have CarPlay in your car, you could have a bunch of automations happen the minute that your phone connects to CarPlay. You can have events trigger when you connect to Bluetooth or Wi-Fi. Those are kind of handy, especially the Wi-Fi ones. If you're going between, say, a work location and home, and you want a bunch of things set different on your iPhone, so maybe go in and change some settings and stuff like that. So there's a lot of different things. Of course, it has geolocation-based stuff, time-based stuff, all those sorts of things. I think this new feature, Create Personal Automation, is going to be very, very handy. But playing around with NFC tags, that's just cool, right? It's just like we're in the future, and Apple's making it possible, and I'm finding the Shortcuts app to be more and more useful with Siri Shortcuts, and now this. I think it's great, and I'm just super excited about it. So I wanted to mention that. Play around with it. Let me know what you think. But with that, that is going to do it for this episode of the MacCast. Before I leave you, I do want to take a moment and thank my show sponsor, Smile, makers of Text Expander, PDF Pen, also Text Expander for iPhone and iPad, along with PDF Pen for iOS and PDF Pen Scan Plus. You can get more information and details on all of their great applications by visiting smilesoftware.com/podcast. Bandwidth for the MacCast is provided by CacheFly. You can find them at CacheFly.com. And all advertising on the MacCast is handled by Backbeat Media. They are at backbeatmedia.com. As always, I love hearing from you. If you have a comment, a question, something you'd like to hear covered on a future episode of the MacCast, you can send your emails and audio comments to maccast@gmail.com. You're also welcome to call in on the listener hotline and leave a voicemail. That phone number, 281-622-4269, 281-MAC-IM-9. If you need show notes, links to anything that I talked about on this or any of any other episode of the MacCast, you can find those on the website. That's at maccast.com. And finally, if you'd like to follow me online between shows, you can find me on Twitter, twitter.com/maccast, or you can check out the MacCast Facebook page over at facebook.com/themaccast. But that is going to do it for now. Hope you have a great, wonderful rest of your week or weekend, however it may be. And I will talk to you all again real soon.